On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we react to another manager firing. That's right, Rob Thomson's time atop the Philadelphia Phillies' top step is over as the Phillies manager was relieved of his duties. We react to it. Also, Travis Bezzana, the number one overall pick in the 2024 draft, he has arrived in the majors making his big league debut in Cleveland on Tuesday night. We're going to talk about that as well. Plus, Shohei Ohtani, pretty good pitcher. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world present for both managerial firings in the previous week. That's Jordan Schusterman. I'm the angel of death, and you don't want me hanging around.
What a privilege for you to get to witness to the two opposite ends of the vibe spectrum when it comes to managerial dismissals. And yes, another manager is down, and Jake was there to see it all. And that is our opener. Rob Thomson is out.
In 2022, the Philadelphia Phillies fired their manager and promoted their bench coach. That propelled them to the World Series, a storybook season for the ages, one that this organization has failed to live up to in the years since. But that magical season was made possible in part due to the stylings, the leadership of one Mr. Rob Thomson. His tenure atop the dugout step is officially over as the Phillies fired Thomson on Tuesday morning. After nearly 4 years on the job, in his stead, they promoted Don Mattingly, 1985 AL MVP, six-time All-Star, Yankee legend. He had been serving as the bench coach. He will now be the interim manager. I got this alert on my phone at around 10:45, like everybody else. And I got in the car, and I drove the 2.5 hours up to Philadelphia to witness this day, this very odd, sad, somber day in person.
I don't know if you had seen the Phillies yet this season. I can't quite remember. Okay, so you had. So you'd seen them in the spring training, obviously. But as their season was starting to spiral, I imagine you were thinking, wow, I should probably at some point go check in here on a team that is heading in a very troubling direction that you probably thought you'd be writing a little bit more positive. Here come the Phillies, the last gasp going for this last run. And the last run is, and I know all these guys are all under contract and Kyle Schwarber's back and whatever, but this era of the Phillies has slowly moved farther and farther away from those glorious highs in 2022. And since then, it's just been about, okay, how long can they get this together? Can they keep this together? And with the start of this season, the tone very much shifted. We, of course, had Matt Gelb on recently, the great Phillies beat writer, to kind of give us that check-in. But it must have been strange for you, this being the first time you saw them this season.
Yeah.
So just as you did with Alex Cora, do you want to take us through the, as you mentioned,
sure,
you hopped in the car and drove up there. Where do we go from there?
So I want to provide a little bit more context here, because when we hypothesized about the end of this Phillies era, if this is it, this is not how we thought it was going to go. I think it is a very good litmus test for people. Are you paying attention to the 2026 Phillies or not? If you're saying that they are falling apart because they got too old, that is just flat out wrong. That is not what is happening here. Maybe if you want to talk about JT Realmuto getting hurt and Aaron Nola, that it might be true in that sense. Bryce Harper, Kyle Schwarber have been awesome. Trey Turner got off to a slow start. He's been heating up in recent days. Like, Zach Wheeler's back. Like, age is not what has doomed this team to this point. Age is not why they went 9-19 and their manager got fired. The real problem, as we talked about with Matt Gelb, was, frankly, unluckiness on the mound and a lack of production in the bottom half of the lineup. And I think those issues can be pegged more on poor roster construction and not a fruitful player development system backfilling some of these roles. And Thompson becomes a very reasonable scapegoat, really the only possible scapegoat here. I would describe the vibe around the Red Sox at Camden Yards as one of shock, anger. They felt blindsided. That is not what it was like at Citizens Bank Park with the Phillies. Now, it's not as if they knew this was coming or they were resigned to their manager's fate, but it was more like guilt-oriented. It was more remorseful. It was weightier. And I think that's because, like, in this business, if you lose that many games in the beginning of the season, like, your manager is going to get fired. And I think that because of it, everything just felt like sadder. It was sadder at Citizens Bank Park. And part of that is because Dave Dombrowski, like, when talking about Rob Thompson, talked about him in a way that Craig Breslow did not talk about Alex Cora, right? Craig Breslow was like, beep, boop, bop, we appreciate your contributions. Like, Dave Dombrowski was like, I love this man. Like,
Dave Dombrowski said more nice things about Alex Cora than Craig Breslow did, which we can certainly get to. But before we get to that part, I do want to keep the focus on Thompson. The other unique element of this sequence was that Thompson decided to also speak, which was rare.
I want
you to set the stage for that. But before you do that, also funny in contrast to Alex Cora tweeting at 4 a.m., posting Instagram stories, whatever. All the contrasts here are hilarious. But I also think for Thompson, thinking about that sentiment of the guilt from the players, this is someone that clearly means a lot to this team that has been through so much together.
Yeah.
But I also think what I was sort of referring to before, you make a great point that a lot of those older players are still the best players on the team, right? Harper, Schwarber, now Wheeler's back. There's a lot still to kind of lean on. But I also feel like after the Phillies lost again last year, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was still a sense of like, not that this is Rob Thompson's fault, but we are heading towards a direction where if this doesn't get any better, as I mentioned earlier, they've gone backwards every year since reaching the World Series in 22, that maybe it's just time for something different, which is basically what
correct
Dombrowski ended up saying. And in the same way that we saw with the Braves, Snicker moving on, and there are other circumstances there, that would have been very natural. Like, if Rob Thompson decided it was more of a mutual parting of ways after this past year, I think we would have had a lot of these same feelings. It would have just felt like more of a natural transition, whoever that would have been. Instead, they stick with him because they have these really deep ties and this strong bond that they've built, and knowing that he's not the problem, clearly, but by the end here, it just, you know, you're 9-19 and the baseball team that has high expectations has to make a change.
I would like to spend a couple of minutes now tipping a cap to Rob Thompson, who is probably done in the dugout. Thompson was going to retire after 2022. He started that season as the bench coach for Joe Girardi. For the season, he said, this is it for me. I'm hanging him up at the end of the year. I'd like to retire. He ends up getting the gig and spending 4 more years as manager for the first time in his life. Rob Thompson, even becoming the manager, is an unlikely story. Grows up in Canada, ends up playing college ball at Kansas, gets drafted by the Tigers, spends 3 years being mediocre in their minor league system, coaches with them for a little bit, and then spends 28 years coaching in the Yankee system. I am 30. Okay? I'm 30 years old. Rob Thompson spent 28 years as a member of the New York Yankees, starting as the third base coach in low A, rising up to field coordinator, director of player development, and then finally Joe Girardi's bench coach during his tenure as manager. That's where he gets the nickname Topper, because Joe Torre, manager of the Yankees during spring training, said that Thompson was on top of everything, always on top of stuff. So he called him Topper. Very confusing for a man who does not have a P in his name. It is not Thompson, it is Thompson. And so that was kind of an unfortunate occurrence. He ends up going from the Yankees to the Phillies when Girardi gets fired to be the bench coach for Gabe Kapler in 2018, which is like an inconceivable pairing to me. Like, what must that have been like? Those two, Kapler, one of the wonkier characters in our game. Thompson, very straight-laced, very wry humor. He stays on when Kapler gets fired and they bring in Girardi. Girardi gets fired in 22. Thompson gets the job. And when he gets the job, his superpower, without sounding mean, is that he's not Joe Girardi. Girardi's issue when he was with the Phillies is that he was too high strung, too overbearing, trying to do too much all the time. And what Thompson did is he took his hands off the wheel. He said, I have a veteran room. I'm going to let them run the show. I'm just going to keep it simple and let them, you know, do this. And it worked. It worked. And I don't think, I asked Dombrowski yesterday, like during the presser, like what changed, right? Because it's pretty much the same room. It's the same group of key players. It's the same manager. Did the players change? Did the manager change? What happened here? And he was basically like, look, we all, Dave got like super meta. He was like, yeah, you know, we all change, man. 4 years, you're not the same you are, you know, as you are 4 years ago, right now. I was like, wow, hell yeah, Dave. And I think that's what happened here is just, it's not even like the message grew stale. It was time for a new voice in that room. And I think everybody around the Phillies yesterday was really appreciative of what Rob Thompson had done for the organization.
And we will get to that new voice in a second. But before we close the book on Thompson, I do want to get back to what I referred to, which is that he also spoke in interesting circumstances. So give a little context of that.
I cannot remember another fired manager doing an exit interview like this, especially during the season. Perhaps it has happened before. I'm sure it has happened before. It's not something I had ever been aware of before. Rob Thompson went to Philly's PR after getting fired and said, I would like to speak to the media today at some point. And so from his condo, like a mile from the ballpark, on Zoom at 5 o'clock, Rob Thompson talked to us. And I asked why in that, you know, Zoom meeting. I was like, Rob, like, why does you want to do this? And he said, look, it's important to be accountable. This is part of the job. I hope that people, whether they liked me or not, saw me as a steward, as a, you know, someone who represented this organization the right way. And this is part of that. I was really impressed by that. I think that you get a lot of cliches in this business and people that don't always live up to those cliches. And to see Rob Thompson like walk the walk was very cool and kind of speaks to who he is as a person. The best things he said, one, he could not stop using we, our, and us when referring to the Phillies. He was like, I'm going to watch our game tonight. I think we have the talent to turn this thing around. That was both cool and heartbreaking in a way. And then someone asked, like, what are you going to do this summer? Because Rob Thompson has not had a summer. And he was like, well, thank God my wife put in a pool. He lives up in Canada in the offseason. He hasn't gotten a Canadian summer since, like, you know, our parents got married. like decades and decades and decades. So like he's going to put on some shorts and get in the pool, you know? And so cheers to Rob Thompson, a baseball lifer, a good dude to deal with. And I wish him the best in retirement.
Yeah. And that him saying we and us is not surprising. It sounds like while he deserves some time relaxing, he's probably going to still, you're going to see him in Clearwater at some point in the next few years. Like he's going to show up and be around. And he's the Phillies, for someone who was a Yankee for nearly three decades, it was really the Phillies that changed. That's, you know, why he's in the position to become a manager. But it's the Phillies that makes Rob Thompson a major character in Major League Baseball after all those years. Mm-hmm. And that is, with that context of, you know, knowing that he was about to retire, it's one of the most remarkable coaching stories that we've had since we've been covering the sport. So to see this ending is definitely a little bit sad, But it is what it is. And now we have to turn the page and look forward for a Phillies team that last night won resoundingly over the San Francisco Giants. And they are 10-19, tied with the Mets, who also won last night. And now we talk about Don Mattingly, who is certainly an interesting character in his own respect, someone who we were also talking a lot about just a few months ago as he made it to the World Series for the first time in his life with the Toronto Blue Jays. He exits there, ends up working for the Phillies with his son, Preston Mattingly, as the general manager. I know you want to give some context on that relationship, some of the misconceptions, fair perceptions, however you want to call
it. Let me get into it right now.
Because Mattingly, of course, becomes important.
I would like to get into this with a tweet, not a tweet, excuse me, with an article from Bob Nightingale at USA Today, who in his story about this wrote, Cora's decision to turn down the job, which I guess we'll have to talk about at some point, leads to the first father-son GM-manager combination in baseball history with Preston Mattingly. Does that make Don Mattingly the first manager who has ever spanked his GM? Did you see this?
Ugla.
Bob
bad.
Wrote that.
Bob.
He wrote that.
What? Bob. Bob. Isn't that, like, let's keep that line in, like, in the press box, maybe. Let's,
It's right here now, on USA Today.
Here's the thing about that.
Yeah.
Man, how much do I want to... Like, is this an anecdote over the years that somehow came up with Bob talking to Don Mattingly?
I don't think Bob has any inside information on Don Mattingly's parenting style. Here's what I believe. I actually don't think he's the first manager that ever spanked his GM. I think baseball is a weird enough place, a bizarre enough ecosystem that this has happened at some point in the last 100 years. That's my take.
Well, the other funny thing about this,
and
I don't know if he's distinguishing this in the, and we'll get back to some real analysis in a second. This is sort of transitioning.
Yeah, I promise.
Direction.
I'm so glad you didn't see this before I told you.
I didn't. That was a real, that was a legitimate jump scare.
This was the talk. Bob. This got more play yesterday at Citizens Bank Park than the Thompson firing. Like, this was the talk of the town.
He refers to first GM manager. I know that front office officials are getting younger, but wouldn't you maybe assume that it would be the reverse? That the GM would be the dad and the manager would be the kid. You know, that's part of this dynamic that's also interesting.
Yeah.
So give us a little context of Preston Mattingly.
Sure.
Give us a little context of Don Mattingly, why he even joined the Phillies to begin with, because I think that is another interesting question that a lot of people were wondering at the time. Why would you leave Toronto? Whatever. So give a little bit on Mattingly. Mattingly's both of them.
The Matting lie. Preston Mattingly is the general manager of the Phillies. He is not in charge of the Phillies. That is particularly true when it comes to the big league stuff. Dave Dombrowski is in charge of the Phillies. And so Don Mattingly becoming bench coach and then manager, to my understanding, is basically like a coincidence that Preston Mattingly is around. Like, I think if Preston Mattingly worked for the Blue Jays or the Marlins or Oregon State, Don Mattingly still gets hired as a bench coach and he still gets hired as the manager. This is cool and interesting and quirky. I actually do not find it to be at all a relevant point in, like, moving forward. I don't think it'll be weird. There is a way it could have been weird if it wasn't literally Don Mattingly, right? It's not like the players in the clubhouse are going to be like, man, is Don Mattingly ratting us out to his son? Like, no. It's Don Mattingly. Like, he's as much of a player's manager as there is. Like, in the, I don't think that is a part of this story at all. Why is Don Mattingly on the Phillies? Let's get to that part. The Phillies went out and hired him to be the bench coach because they wanted a more established voice on the coaching staff. Someone that had a substantial big league career. That was something that they were missing. And in a clubhouse full of stars, They wanted someone with a playing resume that could go up to Bryce Harper or Trey Turner or whomever and be like, hey, we need to do this. You need to trust me and believe me. I'm literally Don Mattingly. That is why they hired Don Mattingly. Okay. Now that he's the manager, what does that mean? If Thompson was taking his hands off the wheel, Don Mattingly might be just like getting out of the car. Okay. He is going to be even less on them than Thompson was. And Mattingly himself was like honest about this. He was asked like, what's the difference between you and Rob? And he was like, honestly, there's not a big one. Like he said that in his scrum, which is both hilarious and revealing and telling. And also like, does being a manager matter? Like he's not, it's more about the Phillies like doing anything of doing a move than the guy they're bringing in. If that makes sense. That's kind of my takeaway.
But that brings us back to Alex Cora. Now, I want to bring that up for two reasons. Okay. The first is just continuing down the contrasts here, which is just amazing. I think when we talked about Cora and that ending and kind of Breslow winning and now we're starting to get the articles. We just got one yesterday where it's like, okay, how did this fall apart? Yep. Where are they going? Well, what are the Red Sox about to change? That was Craig Breslow being like, this is my team. This is how things are going to work around here. I'm Craig Breslow. I'm the chief baseball officer. Whereas with the Phillies,
I'm Craig Breslow.
It was like, okay, it's time to move on to something different. However, we now learn, because Dave Dombrowski is quite honest and because Matt Gelb is a good reporter, that yep. Dave Dombrowski was seeking out what would have been very different than Rob Thompson. And that was Alex Cora. As soon as he is ousted in Boston, it seems that Dave Dombrowski had, with the prior relationship with Alex Cora, of course, had real intentions of trying to bring him to Philadelphia. Which is, I think, telling of this moment, because now when you end up in this Mattingly position, it looks like not a whole lot is changing, which he is admitting blatantly. And you're saying, okay, well, what's the point of any of this? But also something I think to keep in mind for after this season. If Alex Cora has decided I am not doing this right now, that's understandable. That is not that important right in this moment. What matters right now is that the Phillies are still 10-19 and they were expecting to be a contender this season, and they need to find a way, whether it's Don Mattingly, whoever's going to get them back on track, the players playing better, the pitchers getting better luck, whatever that is, what matters is right now. But I think that knowing that Dombrowski had the intention of going after Cora, you have to take something from that. You can't.
Yeah.
And they ended up just falling back on Mattingly. But that does tell me that they did view the need for something more dramatic and they just couldn't get it done for whatever reason. So whether that means Alex Cora is the manager of the Phillies in 2027 or whatever, maybe that's irrelevant. I still think that's a really important part of this story and this sequence that is going to be kind of difficult to ignore as this Phillies season moves forward.
Destiny Legardo of Phillies Nation asked Dave during the press conference, is it fair to assume that Alex Cora will be the manager in 2027? And Dave said no. Do I believe Dave? Not really. I think there could be a scenario in which the season completely falls apart and Dombrowski gets fired. Like they could change the front office in that way. I think that that is in the realm of possibility because the Phillies have been bad at drafting and developing in the Dombrowski era. That is no surprise. That has never been a skill set of his. Todd Zielecki of MLB.com yesterday said that they have matriculated 3 Dombrowski draft picks to the big leagues during his time, like total. Crawford, Painter, Kirkering, that's it.
Kirk, yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now part of that is they're trading guys away because they're competing, but like that's still that's the lowest in baseball over that span. So that's the problem, in my opinion. Like if we're diagnosing something, Dave Dombrowski is very good at the most important skill that a GM or a baseball executive can have, in my opinion. That skill is what, Jordan?
I need some money. Can we spend some money?
I need some money. Can we spend some money? for all of the other stuff, convincing the rich guy to part with his money is more important than a lot of other stuff. And no one in the history of the sport, arguably, has been better at that than Dave Dombrowski. He's done it in multiple places with multiple people time and time again. Dave Dombrowski is not necessarily good at all the other stuff. Like, he could bring in a star, he can make a big trade, but we're seeing kind of the downside of his abilities coming to fruition here at the big league level with the Phillies early in the season. Last thing on Cora. I think that Dombrowski being honest about this was the right move. He didn't really have another choice. And I think that Mattingly and Thompson both handled this well. They're like, look, that's Dave's job. He wanted to go get Alex Cora. He tried. He didn't. Here I am. I'm going to do my best. I don't think that that is going to be a problem moving forward.
Yeah, I don't think I was painting it as some sort of scandal. It's just fascinating. And now we see if the Phillies can start playing better. They have a lot of really good baseball players, just like some of these other teams that have gotten off to awful starts. And I would say even more so. I mean, we've been talking about these four kind of behemoths with expectations and recent runs of success with, now, the Mets, I know, not a whole lot of success, but you know what I mean. But when we've been talking about these disaster starts and how these teams are going to pull themselves out of it, and now two of their managers have been fired, we're talking about the Phillies, we're talking about the Mets, we're talking about the Astros, we're talking about the Red Sox. I know we had differing opinions on how good these teams were going to be coming into the season, but I think we can both agree, even recognizing the struggles of the bottom of this roster, I still think at full health, I think this is still the team I feel the best about of that group. Maybe I would say Boston, but this is still the team that I'm looking at, and I look at the starting pitching and Wheeler being back, and I look at, even if the lineup down the bottom can get closer to respectable, what they still have at the top, this is still the team that I think can be a really good team. And so we talked about that with Matt Gelb. How could they possibly play any worse? But there is enough time, just as there is with the Red Sox and there is with the Mets and there is with the Astros to a degree. I mean, health is going to be important for all these teams, but I do look at this Phillies team and think there is time for them to get back in this. And how that transpires, what that means for Don Mattingly, what that means, does Don Mattingly want to come back and manage in 2027? Like, that kind of seems unlikely, but who knows? So there's so many interesting things about this, and I think we gave a decent summary. So I'm glad you got to see another one there. Not that we're rooting for people to lose their jobs, but I'm glad you got to get the firsthand account. I appreciate that.
I do think the one last thing I want to convey is the schedule leading in to yesterday. The Phillies played three at home against the Cubs, three at home against the Braves, four on the road against the Cubs, three on the road against the Braves. Like, you're playing everyone, whatever. They got two teams, 13 games in a row, that were on freaking fire. That contributed to this for sure. You know, like, there was no rest in there. There was, if they had played the Giants in between that, like, Rob Thompson might still be employed. And as we look forward, Giants, Marlins, A's, Rockies coming up.
Yep.
We said the same thing about the Mets,
Red Sox,
and their Nationals, Rockies, Twins homestand, and that's gone okay. But I think that the Phillies have a similar opportunity ahead of them over the next couple of weeks. And then it's like Red Sox, Pirates, Reds, Guardians, Padres, Dodgers. But like in the short term, Giants, Marlins, A's, Rockies. Let's talk again on May 11th when they're done with that stretch.
That is a good wrap up of Rob Thompson. We salute you. No P. We're going to take a break. When we return, Travis Bazzana is a major leaguer. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Jake has been out and about, up and down the Eastern Seaboard, getting his eyes on some important baseball happenings. But now it's my turn for a field report. Hmm. Travis Bazzana, the first overall pick in what is looking like a potentially historic 2024 MLB draft, made his major league debut last night in Cleveland, a day the Guardians fans have certainly been looking forward to for quite some time. Didn't know exactly when it was going to happen with how well he was performing in AAA. It seemed very likely to come in the first couple months of the season. And indeed, after Monday's incredibly ugly loss against Tampa, the Guardians made the decision to call up their top prospect, Travis Bazzana, whose story and journey to this point as a kid growing up in the northern suburbs of Sydney, Australia, who was obsessed with baseball, who was playing every sport. He was playing cricket. He was, you know, track and field and everything else. I'm sure it was Aussie rules football and rugby and all the other fun games they're playing down there. But all along, Travis Bazzana loved baseball. He just loved it more than his fellow Aussie friends. And he just stuck with it in a way that no one else really has and has that kind of started on this path that very few players from Australia have. There is a history of Australians reaching the major leagues. Many of them are pitchers, and many of them signed as international amateurs. But Travis Bazzana decided to kind of follow a path that has become more popular, which is to come to America and play college baseball. He got that opportunity in part coming over as part of the this organization called Next Gen Baseball, which is organized by former Australian reliever Ryan Roland-Smith, friend of the program and current Mariners broadcaster. That is an organization that essentially helps young Australian ball players get seen by both professional scouts, but also college coaches. And so this is an organization that has existed for a while and kind of fostered the development of kids like Travis to come over and get seen. Oregon State gets wind of this Bazzana kid, and they recruit him, and Travis Bazzana shows up on campus before he even plays his first college game. That summer, he plays in a summer league there, and he wins the league MVP, and he's just immediately the best player as, I guess, an 18-year-old, 17-year-old at that point. And from that point forward, as soon as he was in the lineup at Oregon State, he was in a program that has been pumping out big leaguers and first-round picks. He was special from day one and just carried that all the way to becoming the first overall pick in 2024. And he dealt with some injuries in his first pro season last year, which is part of why we didn't see him last year in the big leagues. He just didn't really have enough time to get up, even though that lineup sure could have used him last year as well. But it was pretty clear once this spring started with how he looked in the WBC representing his country and then how he looked in AAA that this day was coming. And Travis is someone that is you kind of have to have a level of confidence and belief in yourself to come from somewhere like him and to think at a very young age, like, yeah, I can be a major leaguer. And then to go to a place that you don't know and think like, yeah, I'm going to be the first overall pick. You got to have some kind of wiring. And it's very clear that Travis Bazzana has that. And I'm so excited to see how his career unfolds up close. And I could talk a little bit more about his debut, but I wanted to throw it back to you. Just your Bazzana thoughts as you've kind of gotten to know him and just watch him from afar over the years.
I want to just zoom out on Australian baseball a little bit and just provide some context as to why this guy is different. You talk about how most of the players that have come over here are pitchers. There has only ever been one Australian position player to have more than 300 plate appearances in a single season. Okay? Think about that. 300. It's like not actually that much. It's like half a season. You know, Dave Nilsson, who is like the GOAT Australian player, catcher, outfielder, first baseman for the Brewers in the 90s, is the only one. He's the only one. Made an all-star team in 1999. Like, he's the father of us modern Australian baseball. He's the only one. Bazzana will be the second one. He will be the second one probably this season, right? And what is cool about it is his success should lead to more baseball interest back home. In the way that Dave Nilsson has talked about as the spark for Australian baseball, Bazzana has a chance to do that tenfold moving forward if he can become an all-star level player.
Yeah, and the cool thing, and Nilsson, of course, the manager of Team Australia in the WBC, yep. and he's of course still the face of Australian baseball. But as you mentioned, he's redefined what is possible. And I think what's so cool about him is it's not just a story about Australian baseball, although that is certainly what, of course, my story focused on, as well as some really, really cool ties to Oregon State that I would encourage you to go read about Yahoo Sports, meeting some of the families and family good. Members.
I enjoyed that.
That have gone to know Travis over the years. Just a lot of really cool people there. Another person who was there who made the trip, woke up at 5 a.m. to make sure he was there, was Grant Balfour, another former Australian pitcher who, of course, pitched 534 games in the big leagues, which is second only to Graham Lloyd for the most ever. But we've seen Peter Moreland and Liam Hendricks, and we mentioned Ryan Roland Smith, and there have been a couple others more recently. But I mentioned that it's not just a story of Australian baseball. It's a modern baseball development story. It's not just that Travis is clearly very talented and has this special bat-to-ball skills and this unbelievable work ethic and determination and drive and passion, but he is a very modern player. He's someone that has embraced a lot of modern training techniques, and even as someone who didn't even have these resources in Australia, but once he gets to this program in Oregon State and his stateside and is able to be like, hey, I want to get better. I want to figure out how to take this talent and become the best baseball player that I can be. Of course, that's including a lot of training at driveline and stuff like that, and understanding, okay, I'm not the biggest guy, but I can hit home runs with the right approach because I am hitting the ball hard. I can pull the ball in the air. I can attack pitches that I can do damage on. I'm going to draw my walks. All of that is what made him such a comfortable prospect, even if the ceiling wasn't necessarily the same as some of the other guys in his draft. And I want to make sure we talk about that, because I know that's something that a lot of people have kind of been talking about with Travis, as so many of these other guys from that first round have already debuted. But as for him in particular, I just think that he is also self-made and a success story in what is possible when you do have that yeah. combination of work ethic and the access to the resources and knowing what to do with that information and to actualize it into real results as a professional baseball player. And he has, and that's also what gives me confidence that he's going to figure out when he goes through his struggles in the major leagues, which are inevitable. Okay, what do I need to do now to make sure that I'm still a good player? And that's what makes me excited to see. And the way that he's able to verbalize that and communicate that makes it all the more exciting yeah. because this isn't a Corey yeah. Seager personality where it's like, I'm not going to tell you any of my, you're going to know nothing about how I'm doing any of this. All of my work is behind the scenes. I will never. Travis, even in his first introductory press conference and talking to him, you know, since he's joined the organization, he will tell you exactly what he is trying to do, how he got to that point, what he is, what the player he believes that he can be. So he made his debut batting seventh, playing second base. Second base is the position that he has played the most. Because he is a plus runner, there's been some speculation, oh, well, maybe he'd move out to center field. He doesn't have the best arm, which is really why he's mostly been limited to the right side of the infield. But you're looking at someone that is going to reach base a lot and get to probably 15, 20 homers. And I'm really curious how speed becomes a part of his game. This is someone whose stolen base totals really fluctuated a lot in college. I don't know if that was just how the Beavers were using him, whether he wanted to run. I know in the minors, he's dealt with some injuries where that has sort of impacted his running. That's something I'm very interested in this modern game in the big leagues where stealing is in theory easier. I would not be surprised if at some point Travis Bazzano decides, I'm going to steal 40 bases this year. That is something that could also elevate his profile as an overall player, as someone that you want to draft in your fantasy leagues, like all of these things. It would not surprise me if he kind of finds a way to add that to his game. But, you know, defensively, he's going to be a second baseman. I think he's going to be a decent one. The arm is the arm. But I just think that he's as safe as it gets. I just think he's going to be a really good major leaguer for a long time. But I know that when you're the first overall pick and when you're in this class that a lot of people is viewing as potentially historic, both at the time and even now, as some of these guys have made it, people say, oh, well, that's it. That's all he is. Is that really that good? And some yes. of that is fair and some of that isn't, yes. but I it's interesting.
If he is an everyday big leaguer that makes a couple all-star games, like that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
It's not a mistake. No one is losing sleep over that inside Cleveland Guardians HQ. When you say historic, yeah. Jordan, the top 20 of this draft is already looking nuts. I'm just going to fly through very quickly because these are a lot of names that people know. Travis Bazzano, number one. Chase Burns, number two, throwing cheddar for the Reds. Charlie Condon, I was out from the jump. He's looked a little bit better for the Rockies, but
he's going to debut this year. He's going to be something. We're both lower on him. He's going to be a major leaguer and he's going to hit homers. Is he going to be an impact player? I don't know.
Who knows? Nick Kurtz, good player, rookie of the year. Hagen Smith with the White Sox. What's the deal there, Jordan?
Looking better. It was trending in a not awesome direction with the strike throwing, but he is throwing well in AAA. He will also make his debut at some point this year for sure.
Jack Caglione with the Royals. So big league struggles, but very talented player. Who knows? JJ Weatherholt, rookie with the Cardinals. He's been great.
Awesome.
Christian Moore with the Angels is maybe the worst pick of the draft. He's currently in AAA. He's hitting the ball a little bit harder, but if your OPS doesn't start with a one in Salt Lake City, I'm worried about you. Connor Griffin at number nine. Top prospect in baseball. Seaver King at 10 to the Nationals. He's been better. That one, eh. Bryce Rayner, Detroit Tigers shortstop, high school kid. He'll be a big leaguer. He's tracking well. Brayden Montgomery, AAA right now with the White Sox. He's been better than we thought. He's a big leaguer. James Tibbs III, drafted by the Giants, traded to the Red Sox, traded to the Dodgers. Cannot stop hitting home runs at AAA with the Dodgers. How about that? Cam Smith at 14. He's been a lot better this year in the big leagues already. Again, this is not even 2 years ago. Gerangelo Saintja, who was traded from the Mariners to the Cardinals in the Brandon Donovan deal, he's going to be a starter in the big leagues for a long time. PJ Morlando, Braylon Payne at 16-17, Marlins Brewers, Jordan. Either of those guys?
Payne is good. Payne is good. I'm honestly more Theo Gillen at 18. He's having the best year of that bunch. These guys are much farther away, but don't worry. We got a few more big leaguers mixed in here.
Carson Bedge at 19, Treya Savage at 20. This is nuts because we're only at like not even two years removed, and we could have multiple all-stars next season, even this season.
Sure.
I mean, this is a ridiculous.
We could have multiple all-stars this season. Kurtz and Chase Burns could absolutely both be all-stars this season. And that would not be surprising whatsoever. Yesavage just back from injury now, just made his debut last night for this season. He is already, let's not just move past what Trey Yesavage did last year and what he has already become in this game, even though we read already, he's already accomplished a lifetime of achievements in the big leagues and has a whole career ahead of him. And there's more behind him. We're going to see Ryan Waldschmidt with Arizona is going to be up here at some point. He was later in this first round. And some of these high school kids are going to end up being stars too. It's just not, they're not going as fast as Connor Griffin. Okay, fine. But there's some really good players in that mix too. And so, It is a group because on draft day, that top seven really was, you could really argue in any order, and it will be a fun thing to debate. And that's why it's so cool to see how it's gone so far, because in some ways, as expected, it has not gone as expected. You looked at those seven players and you could make a really strong argument for all of them, because what those seven guys did in college are really some of the most remarkable statistical resumes we've ever seen. All seven of them. Mm-hmm. Bazzano, Burns, Condon, Kurt Smith, Cags, Weatherholt. What they did in college was unbelievable. And so you could make these arguments for all of them and be like, oh my God, how can you not take this guy number one? How can you not take this guy in the top three? That's how the order shook out. And it is going to impact all these organizations in a really incredible way for a long time. And then just bringing it back to Bazzano to kind of wrap this here, like, what a rookie class for Cleveland. Parker Messick is looking like one of the best left-handed pitchers in the American League. He's been incredible. Chase DeLauder, we know how he got started. DeLauder's cooled off. He hasn't homered in a few weeks, but he's still putting together some of the best at-bats on the team. And Cleveland, look, they need it. Their offense is clearly better than it was a year ago. Is it good? No. And we've seen that the last couple nights. So anything that they can get from Bazzano, who's now kind of replacing Juan Brito. They've been rolling with this middle infield of Gabriel Arias and Brian Rocchio over the last couple of years, despite well below average offensive production. I think Rocchio has shown enough now that he shifted over to shortstop that he can be a totally competent, useful down order player. Arias is its own conversation. He's injured right now, is trying to come back, but I don't know what the spot is going to be for him and whether he deserves to even get any more playing time. I hope they just roll with Bizana, let him play against lefties, let him get comfortable, because clearly this is a guy that they're building around in a way that some of these other guys have kind of gotten to these place on the roster in different ways. This is the number one overall pick, the only one in Cleveland Guardians history, the one that they had a 2% chance to get on that draft for that draft lottery, right? That's another part of this whole 2024 draft story, is the absurdities of the draft order to begin with because of the draft lottery. And so Bizana is just so important. And I'm glad that an organization that in the past has been so conservative and so patient and so like, no, let's wait, as we saw with the lottery last year. This time it's like, no, let's do it. It's April. We need Travis Bizana. He makes us better. And so now we're going to get to see him do it. So all kinds of other fun stuff from his debut. They lost 1-0. He got intentionally walked in the 9th inning, which you don't see often for someone making their major league debut. And a lot of other cool details that you can read up in my story.
He's the walk-up song is I Come From a Land Down Under, right? By Men at Work.
Yes. And let me talk about that and then we'll take a break quickly. So he does walk up to that. Down Under, of course, Men at Work, maybe the most iconic Australian song. I didn't end up including this in my story, but he did talk about it. He was asked about it afterwards, where it's like, okay, whose idea was that, right? Because you could imagine that this could have been like the veterans were like, let's just give him this walk-up song, like he's a freshman, or he was like, I have to do this, of course, or somewhere in between. And he talked about how throughout his career, when he's had walk-up songs, he's maybe had like a rap song or something more along the lines of what other America ball players have. And his parents have always been like, dude, what are you doing? What is this garbage? Come on, let's do something more representing back home. And oftentimes Travis has kind of shrugged them off. But he said it, in the months leading up to his debut, he kind of had an inkling like, this is what I have to do. This is what I should do. This is the right thing to do. And he was right. So I doubt he's going to keep it for the entirety of his career. But I love that he embraced it. He had a funny line basically being like, yeah, I would tell my parents, I don't need to make it this myself. Everybody knows I'm Australian. That's kind of the whole thing. I don't have to, you know, beat them over the head with it. But my point is, I actually think, now that he's becoming a major leaguer and going into all these stadiums that don't care about the Cleveland Guardians, the MLB draft, they don't know. And I know he's not going to get his walk up in these other parks, but I do think that there are just casual baseball fans, Guardians fans, who showed up last night and heard that song and were like, oh, okay, this guy, whoa, he's from Sydney. That's cool. So I do think that there's maybe more education there that is probably absolutely than he realizes. And I thought that was a really cool moment. So anyway, welcome to the big leagues, Travis Bizana. Excited to cover you, and I'm sure I'll be talking about him again on this podcast this season.
Let's take a break. When we get back, we'll talk about one other important baseball player, Shohei Ohtani. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Almost done with our show, but we have to talk about a big deal first, and that's Shohei Ohtani. Last night, Shohei Ohtani pitched, and he pitched pretty well, going 6 innings, allowing, I believe, just 2 runs against the Miami Marlins. Dodgers lost that game, and they lost that game in part because they couldn't get the offense going. 7 hits for the Dodgers on the evening, none of which were extra base hits. You can really use a big bat in that lineup. I don't know, like Shohei Ohtani. Shohei Ohtani, for the second time in his last 3 pitching starts, did not hit while pitching. This is interesting. This is news, as is often the case with anything Ohtani related. The guy that does both is not doing both all the time at the same time. That is a fact.
Yeah, and man, it's weird. The Dodgers have lost 3 of his 5 starts so far. He has gone exactly 6 innings in all 5 of his starts. He threw a season-high 104 pitches against the Marlins last night, and he does have a 0.60 ERA. Is only one of those runs last night was earned. He has still yet to allow a home run. But let's get back to the topic at hand. He's not hitting. And we speculated coming into the season that we could at least see little hints here and there of a tilt back towards Ohtani the pitcher from a prioritization standpoint. And I think at the time, we were thinking about it strictly from Ohtani's perspective, because for the duration of his career, this dude's calling the shots. He decides when he hits, when he pitches, all these things. It's his schedule. He's the best player. He's the most important player in baseball history, blah, 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 blah. And so we just assumed, okay, if he wanted to start dialing it back, take a few off days at the plate, that was going to be the case. I think what we've learned recently is that the Dodgers are a more relevant character in this. And maybe we are naive and stupid and disrespectful to frame it that way. But I do think that it has been interesting to see that the Dodgers do seem to be at least nudging him in situations like this, where they have a day game today, I believe, which I assume means he will be hitting today. And so they're just looking for opportunities for him to expend slightly less energy, which in turn allows him to spend the most energy on the mound, which thus far, even though they've lost three of his five starts, he's doing his job pretty freaking well on the mound. And so it's hard to say that that part hasn't really been working.
This is from Dave Roberts, pregame on Tuesday via friend of the program, Jack Harris of the California Post. Quote, obviously, having him do both duties in theory, in practice, it's great. Yep. But how sustainable is it without kind of taking a little bit off his plate a little bit? That's the question. It's not an exact science. His goal is to make every start. So with that, there has to be some compromise and some openness to kind of read and react. So far, I think we're doing a nice job and he's open to that. Earlier in the week, Andrew Friedman on the radio, AM 570, said it doesn't make sense for him to go wire to wire as both a pitcher and a hitter, playing every day and pitching every week. That's hard. That's hard is so funny from Andrew Friedman. Like, oh man, what Ohtani's doing is it's difficult, man. That's tough. Tough. It's hard. It's like, well, yeah, dog.
Yeah, go ahead.
It makes sense. Like, the goal of the season is to win the World Series, not for Shohei Ohtani to hit as many home runs as he can during the regular season. That has changed. Ohtani, the hitter, has been a little bit worse than you might expect. He's still, like, really good. But he's just really good and not elite. Like, if Ohtani was only hitting, he would not win the MVP this season, based upon how he has performed so far. Right?
Yes.
Which is different than 2023, when he was just the only hit and was incredible. And so I understand why the Dodgers are kind of monitoring this. It takes more energy for him to do both. That is reasonable. And I think that it is unfortunate, but it is also like a sign that things are changing. When he was in Anaheim, Ohtani just ran the show, got to do whatever he wanted. And now the Dodgers are like, hey, man, like, we're good enough as a team that you don't need to carry all the rocks in your backpack. Like, we have other people. Like, we literally have Freddie Freeman and Will Smith and leadoff hitter Dalton Rushing, that you don't need to hit every time you pitch if you think that's going to help you perform on the mound. So far, that's been the case.
Unless you're facing Jansen Junk, in which case, apparently, you need a whole lot more help, Dodgers. Shout out to Jansen Junk, who was just dominating the Dodgers last night, which was cool to see. I think I'm not going to get tired of talking about Ohtani going for the Cy Young, because I think it's so interesting and frankly a math problem that I will be tracking the whole season. And as long as his ERA continues to begin with a 0 point, I will continue to look at this on a start-by-start basis. I've continued to reference his 2022 season, which is when he came closest to winning the Cy Young. He finished fourth. He made 28 starts and threw 166 innings. with his current schedule, I know last night he threw on one fewer day's rest. I'm skeptical he can get to 28 starts, but I haven't quite sketched it out. But let's say that he does. Let's give him 28 starts, right? And let's say he throws exactly six innings in every start. We know that's not going to be the case. That would get him to 168 innings, which is slightly more than that previous career high. Is it enough to be in the mix for the Cy Young? I'm inclined to say yes, because I think that just so few pitchers are even getting to 200 anymore. We'll see. This is going to involve so many other pitchers and how they're doing, whatever. Paul Skeens is going to have more innings than that. I feel pretty good about that. But where he's averaging in terms of innings per start, what his pace is for how many starts he's going to get, and if he continues to have the lowest ERA in the National League, all of these things are very fun to track while he continues to hit. And listen, the dude's got an 898 OPS, which is
incredible.
Which again, incredible. which is amazing. It's just lower than what it's been the last three seasons. But I am excited too, in the way that in 2024 he was doing just the hitting and we got to follow 50-50 and all those things and just focus on that. I know he is doing both now still. His starts now are just the whole, last night I was a little busy, but in general, I will look forward to them every week and just thinking about that singular focus within the goal of the Dodgers winning another World Series.
I don't know if I believe what I'm about to say, but I would like to say it out loud. Are we underrating how many innings Ohtani's going to throw? Right now, he has thrown more innings than Paul Skeens, despite having one fewer start. He has gone six innings in every single start. He has made all of his starts. He made his first start last night on a five-day rest cycle. Like, what if he just throws 30 starts? And the way that the Dodgers kind of handle that load is just by having him hit less, as they've done. Like, I think that is than we anticipated.
That's the real question. Okay, if we begin with, all right, Shohei, you're not going to hit when you pitch. If we start building in more off days the day before or the day after, if we start, because we think that we're lessening his load, we're now asking for fewer days off between starts. If we start moving in that direction, you might be right. I'm still skeptical of that. As I said, I haven't totally done the math and sketched it out how many starts he would make right now if he stays on rotation and whatnot. And while the Dodgers pitching so far, by the way, at some point they're going to get Blake Snell back, it seems. And they have all these other pitchers that they can still throw that is not going to push them to need to have Ohtani start, you know, making his starts on 4-5 days rest. So all those things are going to impact it. But you might be right. You might be right. I just think that if it starts moving in that direction and we start seeing days off beyond when he's pitching, that's when we can have that conversation more seriously.
I just think it's more possible than we maybe anticipated at the outset of the season. So,
yeah, that is valid. But hey, justice for Paul Skeens. He had the disaster on opening day, and then the other start was shortened because of the rain. So he would have gone deeper in that game if the rain didn't stop him. Okay, we're done. We did it. We did a podcast. Some other interesting happenings on Tuesday night that we will get to later this week. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Rosas for producing. We will be back on Friday with another episode of Baseball Barbacast. You can email us, baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Will Jake have another manager fired before Friday? I don't think so.
I'll do my best to
not. But if he does, what a pattern that would be. Thank you all for listening. We'll talk to you on Friday.